of the debate that almost was. We started out with the idea that the debate between Gail Wilensky and Robert Reichauer would be exciting, but the dates didn't work out, and so each of them have made presentations, and those of you who've heard Robert Reichauer know that he saw some opportunities for winners, and today we're going to find out if there are opportunities also as Gail Wilensky sees it. Her topic is the Medicare bill. Who are the winners and losers? She's a senior fellow at Project Hope, of whom one of our own, Felicia Rogan, is a member of the board. And testifies before Congress, advises members and other elected officials, speaks nationally and internationally. From 2001 to 2003, she was a member of the President's Task Force to improve healthcare delivery for both veterans and military retirees. From 1997 to 2001, she chaired the Medicare Payments Advisory Commission, which advises on payments and other issues relating to Medicare. 1995 to 1997, she chaired the Physicians Payment Reviewing Procedure. Review procedure. Previously was deputy assistant to President George H. Bush for policy development, advising on health and welfare. And one could go on almost indefinitely with the number of positions that she's held and the distinction that she's achieved. But perhaps the best thing is to turn to her for winners and losers.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I've done something that I hope you will indulge me in, which is that having engaged in the debate about winners and losers with a number of people, including Robert Reichauer, I decided to talk about something that caught my fancy about 6 weeks ago, and that is the issue of the politics of healthcare reform. It involves, of course, the Medicare bill as part of the politics of healthcare reform, but I'm going to look at this more broadly speaking. As it happened, Bob Reichauer and I had a chance to duke off on this as well at the Kennedy School a couple of weeks ago, where we were both asked to be on a panel to talk about the politics of healthcare reform, and in particular, whether incremental reform would still work or whether we were beyond incremental reform and needed to go with a big bang of healthcare reform. So this is indeed the other half of a debate with Robert Reichauer, but not quite the one I was initially going to do. I'm going to walk through some of the issues it was the downward button, as I assumed. This issue struck me as being important to share with people as part of a talk that I did for the new governor of Louisiana in the spring at a healthcare summit that John Breaux organized for the new governor. And it was trying to look back at what we can learn from our major attempts at healthcare reform and to put it into the context of what we are hearing now as we go through an election cycle. And in particular, it struck me as being important because there were things I was hearing and polls that I was reviewing that looked hauntingly familiar, and I tried to understand whether or not this was signifying a next round of potential healthcare reform or not. And that's really what I want to share with you today. Several observations about looking at our attempts to reform healthcare. The first is that it's a tough sell at any time. I'm going to explain why it's going to be particularly difficult in the next likely session of Congress. Second, it is, as I've indicated, particularly challenging right now. But as importantly, I think it is urgent for the public not to get fooled by some of the polls. It's important to understand what polls are saying. It's important that politicians understand what the polls suggest and what they don't suggest. And I want to explain as I go through why that's the case. First thing is that polling data frequently shows that healthcare is an important issue. Now, that's in general true, and I'm going to show you a little polling data to verify that that's the case. But it's especially true in this election and in our past most recent elections. And the reason is because of the swing voters. We are living in a time where there is a large camp who will vote for the Democratic nominee, almost no matter who the Democratic nominee is. We live at a time when there's a large group of Republicans who will vote for the Republican nominee, almost no matter who that Republican nominee is. And what is important for a nominee is to try to capture those swing voters. They're the ones that really move who, in fact, will win a national election. So the fact that healthcare appears to be a particularly important issue for swing voters is more important than the numbers would suggest, because they are the ones that will swing the election one way or another. And the third reason we almost always hear about healthcare in an election is that Democrats really want to have healthcare be an election issue. They regard it as their issue, and they're right. The public typically feels much more comfortable at what Democrats will propose with regard to healthcare than they do with regard to what Republicans are proposing. This is not a new area for presidents to try. Lots of presidents have tried to take on healthcare reform. Generally, they have not done well. And even when they succeed, it can be a tough sell. And we clearly are seeing that right now with regard to the Medicare bill. I was one of a number of policy analysts who did not think there would be a Medicare bill passed in the session of Congress, not because of the issues. People have long believed that prescription drugs needed to be a part of the Medicare bill, but rather the politics did not seem likely to produce a bill. It seemed much more likely that Democrats would want to run on the issue of needing a prescription drug bill than helping to pass a prescription drug bill. And without Democrats, particularly in the Senate, joining and supporting a bill, you weren't going to have enough votes to be able to get the bill outside of a filibuster. And in fact, had it not been for the very active support and participation of Senator Kennedy to pass S-1, the Senate bill, last June, there never would have been a bill to go to conference to iron out the differences. So I was surprised that it happened, but as is clear, this has not been the win for President Bush that he and others might have thought it would be. So it is important to understand, not only is it hard to get health care reform, but even when it happens, sometimes it's a win and sometimes it's not a win. If you look at the polling, it looks like affordable health care is a big issue once again. After the economy, people are saying that's their next priority. Now, it's not close. Most people say economy and jobs is their number one priority. Excuse me. But large numbers say that they're worried about affordable health care. And there's also a majority of people who are saying that they're dissatisfied with today's health care system. When I looked at some of the numbers, and I've been at a number of conferences where people were reporting these numbers, I was having a deja vu all over again experience. I think I've seen this before. I went back to a large loose leaf of 35-millimeter slides that I had from talks I did in 1992, and then after the election in 1993 and 1994, when all of the discussion about the Health Security Act was going on. And indeed, when you go back and look at that period, there is a lot about the polling that is hauntingly familiar. The numbers and the significance of the numbers that I just reported to you in terms of the declining satisfaction in healthcare reminded me of the comment that James Carville had made so famous in the 92 election, it's the economy, stupid, and healthcare is in crisis. Now, I'm not normally one who quotes James Carville, but I think in this case he really did get it right. If you look back at what people were saying in the 1992 election, there are some very strikingly similar numbers compared to what we are seeing right now. The majority of people indicated it was going to take a lot of change in order to fix the healthcare system. Only 25% saying that basically our healthcare system is okay and only minor changes are needed. If you put together significant change is needed and radical change is needed, the two more aggressive pieces, the blue at the top, that sort of teal color, and the reddish at the bottom, you get over two-thirds of the population saying either significant change or radical change is needed in order to fix the healthcare system. All right. Need some help in order to... Okay, thank you. But one of the things that we have discovered painfully following the Health Security Act activity, that as appealing as healthcare reform is during an election period, it's very different to take on healthcare issue as an election item and healthcare issue as a legislative item. And it's important that we all try to learn something from our past experience. I'm going back again to some of these 35-millimeter slides that were then put onto PowerPoint that reflected where the public moved to as the Health Security Act was discussed in the 1993 period. September 22, 1993, President Clinton introduced his proposal, his Health Security Act, in the Capitol. Had the announcement in the Capitol. I was privileged to be on the upstairs tier when that was happening. And when that started, there was two-thirds, roughly, about 60% of the population that said they were in favor of the bill as they understood it in at least general detail. And about a third, about 33%, who said they were opposed to it. Over the course of the following 10 months, basically those numbers reversed. And instead of having 60% say that they were in favor of it, you had close to that, about 56, 57% saying that they were opposed to it, that they were opposed to it now, and those who were in favor were down about 38%. So a dramatic change. In a relatively short period, from the end of September until July of that next year. And more importantly, for both the Democrats and the Republicans, a huge response to scaring the daylights out of a lot of people in terms of what was being proposed, with ultimately the election of a Republican House and a Republican Senate. Now, there will for some time be debates about why that happened. To me personally, I think the Health Security Act, while not the only cause, was the single biggest cause of that election. So this is not a small deal. And while the Senate from time to time switched between the Republicans and the Democrats, this was a cataclysmic event in the House of Representatives where it became Republican for the first time in 40 years. So this was not, oops, we made a small miscalculation as we try to push this bill through the Congress. What is interesting and really a word of warning to politicians who might think too much of some of the polling that they're seeing is that there is hauntingly similar disconnects between what was being reported then, with far too many politicians ignoring, and what is being reported now. What people were saying, as I've indicated, is we need major change. I showed you the 68% saying either significant change or radical change at around the election time. This was coming slightly after in the 93, early 94 period, and still a little under 60% of the people are saying our nation has a healthcare crisis. But it was the nation who had a healthcare crisis. At the same time, an even larger number of people, 65, 75%, it depended exactly when you looked and how you phrased the question, but a large number of people, an even larger number of people were saying, my healthcare is okay. So the country is in crisis, but my healthcare is okay. The country would be better off with something like the Health Security Act, but not me. And at the same time, almost 60% saying the country will be better off, but most people saying I'm not going to be better off. Similar disconnects in terms of what to do. People saying employers should be required to provide health care coverage, large number, but not if it costs any jobs. So these kinds of disconnects were out there, but not all of the politicians were paying any attention to what it means when people are saying, the country has a problem, I'm okay, thank you. Require employers to provide health care insurance, but not if it means jobs. You see, and this is really what has started me thinking about this issue and the politics of healthcare reform, you see some of the very same things if you try to probe beneath some of the polling. Now, sometimes you have to do a little work to find this because people don't always stick these questions together. But if you look around at what people are saying, they are once again saying most Americans are saying that the healthcare system is not meeting the needs of Americans in general, but it is meeting my needs. Now, the number comparison isn't quite the same, but the general message is the same. Watch out when people say the system is failing, it needs to be fixed, but oh, by the way, my health care is okay or fine, because watch out when you do something that people perceive may change their health care, which, by the way, was fine before you started doing this. Again, this notion of employer mandates, which I actually thought had finally been beaten down into the ground. I'll be glad to talk with you about why I think employer mandates are not a good idea in the 21st century. But again, this disconnect between it's one thing to require employers to provide health insurance coverage, it's something else if it costs jobs. Again, this having of support. There is a lot of people saying they support having increased state programs. If you say it raises taxes, that drops down, but it's still pretty high. I don't know that I would personally want to be the politician that tried to see whether or not people were just fooling when they said that they would still support it, even if it raised taxes. Now, there's some political facts of life that you just need to understand if you want to reform healthcare, which I would like to, which many people on both the right and the left would like to have done. The first is that there are deep divisions within the political parties when it comes to health care reform, except during an election. During an election, Republicans hang together, usually, supporting their candidates. During an election, Democrats usually hang together and support their candidate. After the election, forget it. They are back to their usual tricks. Second fact of life is that universal coverage, a goal that many politicians on both the right and the left have said they support, means if you mean it literally, either a mandate on somebody, the employer, the individual, or both, or a new entitlement, or both of those together. This is not a small issue in the American political world. Third thing is, if you want to subsidize poor and low-income people, to bring them into insurance. About a third of the uninsured are below the poverty line. It is going to cost real money. No getting around it. The fourth thing is watch out for those inconsistent public attitudes, because people tend, at the end of the day, to not forget about how they think they themselves will be impacted. And that's not a small issue. And sometimes they fool you. Now, I spent, as you heard, a short amount of time, most of the last year of 1992, in the White House after running the Medicare program for the previous 2.25 years. And I learned a very valuable set of lessons when I was there. These are going to sound very simplistic, but it appears to me that occasionally politicians coming to Washington for the first time don't remember this all the time, and it usually reaches out and bites them if they don't. It doesn't matter when you're in an administration how wonderful your ideas are to provide domestic policy change. If it requires new legislation, that is, if it can't be done administratively, only Congress gets to pass new legislation. So you're in the White House or you're in the agencies, but it's only your friends down the street that actually get to make new legislation happen. Second fact of life is that it's really important to count votes. Now, that's pretty obvious. But in healthcare, it's tricky. It's not just a matter of counting the R's and the D's. And the reason is that on healthcare in particular, some of the D's, some of the conservative Democrats, dislike certain provisions like employer mandates and global budgets and get nervous about price controls almost as much as the Republicans. And when you're counting who's going to support what kind of legislation, you really need to make sure it's not just counting the R's and the D's, but knowing who's going to vote for your legislation. Now, the same is true on the Republican side. There are some Republicans who are as likely to vote with the Democrats as they are with the Republicans. And that means you've got to really know who's where. When it comes to organization, voting for a committee chairman, almost always people vote as an R or as a D, however they were elected. But when it comes to passing legislation in some of the areas, and healthcare is number one among them, you really have to know who's in what camp or you're going to get burned when it comes to passing legislation. It's a very serious issue for President Clinton. He had a Democratic House and he had a Democratic Senate, but he never had 218 votes in the House and 50 votes in the Senate, not from the get-go. There were large numbers of conservative Democrats who were as opposed to provisions of the Health Security Act as any Republican. And when you looked at who was where, there was never a point in time that there was anything like 218 votes in the House or 50 votes in the Senate, which is what you need if you're going to get legislation passed. If you have a closely divided Congress, as we do right now, and as I'm going to argue we are likely to have in the next Congress, it makes it tough to do health care reform. And if you have that and split government, it makes it even harder. Well, what does this mean? It's too early now. It's clear that polling has been very volatile with regard to the presidential election. I believe in the end it will mostly depend on how people feel about the economy. If you ask in July and August whether people expect to have their job or a better job next year relative to this year, and if they anticipate being better off economically and financially next year than they are this year, that helps President Bush. If they say, irrespective almost of what the numbers suggest, they're uneasy about their job, they do not feel economically secure, or they're insecure in other ways, then that is supportive of candidate Kerry. Though that, I believe, is the major issue. Obviously, Iraq could continue to be an issue as well. Most analysts believe that the House is going to stay Republican. And while I haven't seen as many projections yet with regard to the Senate. More Democratic seats are up now than Republicans. This is in reverse to what has occurred during the last two elections. So it is likely that the Senate will stay Republican as well, although, again, I haven't seen the projections as much as what's likely to happen in the House. So what that means is one of two outcomes is probably going to be in our future. Republicans stay in control, but with small margins, or we have split government, and again, with small margins. And neither of those are very good for health care reform. If you think back to how did we get Medicare and Medicaid passed in the mid-1960s, it was with an overwhelming support in the Congress for one party. When that happens, whichever party it is, they are likely to be able to get through major social legislation. But if you don't have 60 real votes in the Senate, then you have problems of cloture, of getting around people who want to filibuster the bill. The House operates under more tightly organized rules, and so a simple majority, if you can keep your members voting as a pack, is usually sufficient. But in the Senate, you really need either 60 votes, well, you need effectively 60 votes. They don't need to be in your party, again, as we learned with S1 in the Medicare bill. And the fact is, having the deficits is just going to make it even harder for health care reform. There's a lot of pressure to match any additional increase in spending with increased revenue. Deficits frequently are accompanied by what are called reconciliation bills. That is one big bill that wraps up all of the budget and anything else that is going to get passed during that session of Congress into one big bill. You can slip pieces of health care reform, little pieces, in a reconciliation bill. But it's hard to have a big bill as part of a reconciliation package. It's not a surprise that the Medicare bill, with all of the change that it encompassed, was a standalone bill and not part of a reconciliation bill. And of course, we have a small problem, like we talk a lot about health care reform, but there really isn't the consensus that you would need in order to get major kind of change passed easily, which is, of course, partly why we see either split government or government that is very closely divided. I think you could make a pretty good argument right now that the Senate, although it is nominally Republican, in health care issues, is really slightly Democrat, again, because of the number of Republicans who frequently will vote for Democrat is greater than the number of Democrats who frequently vote with Republicans when it comes to health care issues by one or two. And so that in health care, it's probably 49-51 with the Democrats leading in terms of health care issues rather than what it nominally is of 49-51 with the Republicans leading. That's a pretty gloomy picture. I think we can start and do some things about health care reform. I vote for this idea, which is, as I mentioned earlier, we have a third of the uninsured population literally poor, that is, below the poverty line. Now, we know who's going to pay for people who are poor. There may be some debate about where being poor stops. Is it the poverty line? Is it 125% of the poverty line? Poverty line for a family of four, by the way, is about $16,500, to put some numbers around this. But when it comes to talking about the poor and those slightly above them, we know that that's going to be publicly financed. So my vote would be, let's start there. And there are a limited number of choices. People usually hate Medicaid unless somebody is threatening Medicaid for some reason. And then they become Medicaid defenders. That's my observation, both from having run it for a couple of years and also talking about it since then. The choices really are expand Medicaid to some of the populations, single adults and adults without children are the biggest numbers of people. But in some states, it's people who are poor, but not so poor as to still qualify for Medicaid, supplement Medicaid, or replace Medicaid. And one of the ideas to try to bring in some of the Republicans might be to allow people to take the money that they would get under Medicaid and use it elsewhere if they want to. Now, frankly, Medicaid gives you a lot of benefits for not much money, so I don't know that you would have many takers, but it might be important in principle to allow people to have that option. So for me, it would be major health care reform is going to be hard. Let's start by bringing in all of the poor uninsured. We could have done this, by the way, in 93 and 94. I have a hard time forgiving the Congress and the administration for not having done that then, because both Republicans and Democrats were supporting at least that. People broke in consensus once you started talking about 150% or 200% of the poverty line. We ought to do what we can. Covering the non-poor, and again, whether we mean those above 125% or those above 150% of the poverty line or more, is going to be much harder. Who pays? How much should they pay? How much should we pay out of taxes? How much should we pay by cross-subsidizing or some other device? And how should we finance it is much less clear and subject to much less consensus. There are some people, typically Republicans, who say we ought to financially empower individuals, give them money, give them either tax credits, refundable tax credits, some way to be able to financially buy insurance and let them have access to group insurance. There are some people who want to have buy-ins for public programs. There are some people who want to mandate insurance coverage, either on the individual, Senator Breaux was somebody who went down this path, or go back to the employer mandate. Senator Kennedy has been talking about this. And sometimes people mix and match these. They'll try to put them together. But this is tough. And it's at least, depending on how you define it, two-thirds of the population who are not technically poor if you start going close to 150% of the poverty line or up to 200% of the poverty line, you start talking about 40 or 50% of the uninsured population. So it's not a small population. It is going to be much harder. That's why I vote, let's start with the poor. It's pretty clear who's going to pay. We are. We only have to decide how and precisely the means. To me, although I am once again hearing not only employer mandates, which I thought, as I said, was a bad penny that had gone away, but people making statements about whether the time has passed for incremental reform, my view is better not. We're in real trouble if the time has passed for incremental reform, because I can't see any scenario in the near term that makes it look likely that we're going to get the big bang of reform, and I'm personally tired of waiting, and I would assume if you're a poor and insured person, you're a lot more tired than I am of waiting. I don't even think in concept incremental reform is nearly so bad. Bob Reichauer has used the term sequential reform. That may even make it clearer in people's minds why it might not be so bad. If you know where you're going, you know where you want to go, then taking a number of steps to get there is perfectly reasonable. Yes, the transitions will be tougher and messier, but we might be able to do that. And I think it's time for us to stop taking a position of universal coverage or don't bother with anything smaller. It's not worthwhile. If we insist on the big bang of reform or nothing, we're likely to continue our path of nothing. I think we can do something, but it's important to understand people may talk about how the healthcare system is in crisis and needs to be changed, but when you start probing them a little more, they typically are okay with their own healthcare, and that means watch out if you, the politician, are about to do something which is fundamentally going to change or threaten their healthcare, which, by the way, they thought was okay after all. In order to change the health care of other people, which they thought needed fixing, but is going to leave them worse off. We might talk like we mean that, but at the end of the day, at least thus far, people really don't mean that. So I'm for trying to take them for what they might mean, pushing it forward, and coming back to the table another time and doing the next piece when we have some agreement and consensus about what that might mean. So it's up on the table, but don't get fooled. It's happened before. We want to get something done this time. Thank you. That was my 30 minutes.
The first questions will be asked by Carolyn Engelhardt and Peyton Weary. They really run this program, and Peyton Weary would have read this announcement that I made, except he looked at it and he said it's worse than doctor's prescriptions, and I can't read either one. So.
Does this work? No, it doesn't work. I agree. Is that working?
No, use this one.
I agree with you that. I don't know. Is it working? I agree with you that incremental reform is probably the only way to go. And in fact, I think if the original Hillary Clinton plan had been incremental, it possibly could have gone through. But my question is this. We keep hearing about the fact that the enormous costs of developing coverage for the poor, additional costs, could be very much offset by the emphasis on prevention, the cost shifting that goes on now regularly. The cost shifting that goes on right now when patients are admitted to the hospital, indigent patients, it's cost shifted. Does anybody have any really good information about comparable costs that would be accrued if one did develop coverage for the poor, indigent, and how much of that, of the initial cost, would be offset by that type of prevention and cost shifting being reduced or eliminated?
Estimates, yes. Good estimates, probably not. And there's a caveat even with regard to the estimates that exists. Last week, as part of the Cover the Uninsured week, another study was released. I think the estimate was something like $50 billion additional dollars to cover the uninsured. I'm not sure I believe that number. I may be misquoting it, but it was not a huge increase. Maybe it was 5%. That may be where the 5 comes in my memory. Now, part of that, of course, is almost by definition, when you're spending $1.6 trillion on healthcare, nothing you're going to propose for 15% of the population is going to be that big, particularly when we have public programs that already pick up those who are the sickest and most disabled of the population. So almost by definition, it won't be a huge number to bring them in. But there will be some considerable redistribution over what is now spent. And that's both the good news and the bad news, but we shouldn't ignore the fact that even if the additional amount isn't that different, how it's funded and who is funding it is going to have a lot to say about whether or not people are supportive or not supportive. A lot of care is now funded, as you know, and any of the people who are involved in providing health care in this room know, informally in a cross-subsidized way by other individuals, knowingly or not, usually not, as opposed to knowingly, in terms of how it's financed. Making it explicit is better in many ways, but it isn't without its dangers because it points out exactly what is going on and who's paying for it. So it's not just the fact that there is additional spending, but that even some of what is now being covered will become more explicit than it is. Now, could we do better in terms of using preventive care and other measures to try to make it not so much? And the answer is we could definitely do better, not just for the 15% who are uninsured, but the 85% of us who are insured, if we would behave better in terms of how we eat, how we exercise, not smoking, not engaging in substance abuse, not engaging in excessive alcohol, a type of substance abuse, we would do a lot better, obesity now being regarded as the number one health problem in the U.S., and we can spend a lot smarter. There's a lot of information that's being generated on things that we don't do that we should, things we do that we shouldn't, poor patient safety measures, and I'm hopeful that maybe we'll start putting there. But we shouldn't discount the fact real money is about to get put on the table if we cover most or all of the uninsured or a large number of the uninsured. Some of it will be just redistribution of what's now being spent, but it will be clear, and whoever is being asked to pay for it explicitly will notice it.
Hi. Thank you so much for your talk. It was wonderful. It was nice and comprehensive, and in language I think everyone could understand very well. My question surrounds the morning after. In 1994, when the Clinton health care plan finally died, or was not going to be, what happened was employers, businesses, people who actually purchased the majority of the health insurance, health care in this country, said, okay, we gave you your chance, we're going to take it into our own hands because premiums are so high, and managed care came in, and we all know what happened with that. I suspect we're seeing that same trajectory now with health insurance premiums going up, and that if something doesn't happen legislatively in the election, as you mentioned, that employers once again will take matters into their own hands. And one of the ways they're talking about doing that and are experimenting are with defined contribution plans. So my question is to you is, do you think that moving toward increased cost sharing by employees and actually probably segmenting the health insurance pool by these new products will push us more towards comprehensive reform, or will it be just what the doctor ordered?
Well, you ask about four or five questions, and they're all very interesting. Let me try to give you some short answers to put this in perspective. First place, employers started aggressively making use of their positions as first purchasers before 1994. They pushed harder. PBMs, those groups that buy pharmaceuticals from the pharmaceutical manufacturers in groups, really came to the fore after the Clinton health care plan failed. But actually, if you look at employer-sponsored insurance and the premiums, they started dropping. I have a slide that shows that. Just precipitously, starting in 1991 until about 1997, and then started on the upturn. This is one of these interesting cases that people haven't paid enough attention to, which is that the private sector was able to produce rates of increase in healthcare that were less than the rate of general inflation until about 1997, particularly in that period, 94 to about 97, which is extraordinary. Now, they did it using strategies that people decided they weren't too crazy about, using what has been dubbed managed care. A lot of it was just mindless discounted fee-for-service, not any kind of integrated care, any kind of management of services. But they were very successful, and in the no good deed goes unpunished category, starting around 1997 and 1998, got a lot of pushback from the population, the public at large, physicians who hated having both their income and their autonomy pushed and questioned. Congress got a lot of pressure to do something about the evil HMOs. There was a variety of legislation that was discussed, but mainly the payers who had driven a lot of this slowdown in spending said, okay, you want to have open access to your specialists and to technology? We know how to do that. And the managed care plans that were going to survive and thrive stopped being as aggressive in terms of their purchasing. Some of us said, guess what's going to happen next, guys? You might not like what you had. Nobody was paying attention about the positive effects it did, only the fact that they got a health care system they hadn't chosen for the most part, and nobody had warned them about, in fairness. It's not a big surprise, particularly after the first two or three years of the Balanced Budget Act, which just whacked Medicare every which way, and therefore held spending down in the public sector, that we are seeing rapid rises. And the real question is, what do we do next? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't think we've decided as a country. There is a lot of interest in what's dubbed consumer-driven healthcare plan. I actually am a big fan of a defined contribution system where an employer, or in the case of the federal government pays the same amount whether you get an expensive plan or an inexpensive plan, because it changes the financial incentives that people who are buying a healthcare plan face and has them think about what kind of trade-offs they think are worthwhile. I actually like the high deductible plan notion, particularly if you have some preventive care that's exempted from the deductible. I think it might get people more involved in terms of thinking about where they go and who they see. But I don't think it's going to solve the problem. And the reason is, once you have any kind of significant medical event, you're going to blow through any deductible anybody puts out there. I mean, you can't have an encounter with the hospital system and not blow through a $2,500 or $3,000 deductible. And once you start looking at where all the money gets spent, which are the relatively small numbers of people who spend a lot of money, we're still going to have to worry, how do we spend smarter for them? So I don't know whether we'll go this way, because Americans seem to love to overinsure. I mean, that's why you have people who buy $100 deductible car insurance plans. If any of you have them, change them immediately. It makes no sense whatsoever. We'll see whether they do that, but it doesn't really beg the harder question. How do we spend smarter in the places where it really starts to add up, which are the 1, 5, 10, even 20% of the population that spend all the money? So that's not, you know, I'm a supporter of them. I hope they work. I think we can find ways to compensate people who have predictably higher expenditures if we think it's unfair for them. We can fix that, but it's not going to resolve that big issue anyway of where all the money goes.
Some short questions.
Shorter answers is a problem.
I'd like to hear your comments on a piece of legislation that did pass, mm-hmm. the Medicare prescription drug bill, to see which impact you think that's going to have.
Let me start by saying, I don't know of a single soul who looks at the Medicare prescription drug bill and says, that's what I most wanted to see passed. It is a piece of legislation that has bits and pieces to try to appeal to the various groups it would take to get it through. And I do believe that it was as much of a bill as you could get through this Congress. And so for me, I think that it's a question of, did we want to have a prescription drug bill now with $400 billion in the budget, or did people want to wait until some other day when they thought they could get a better bill? I think the right decision was made, because if you are low income, you are definitely better off. If you have very high expenditures, you are definitely better off. In between, it's kind of a peculiar benefit, because it has that hole in the middle where there is coverage for the first $2,250 after you get through the $250 deductible, where the person pays 25% and the government pays 75%, and then you have that space where there's no coverage. Well, there's no way to justify that on a policy ground to have that opening. But if you were going to not have a very large deductible, that's what you had to do. Now, without politics aside, what I would have preferred to have seen is keep all the support for the poor and low income, start with a catastrophic provision and start working back. And when you ran out of money, you ran out of money. And if it meant a deductible of $2,500, from then on you would have 95% coverage or whatever it was. That is politically not very appealing to either party in terms of what they want to do, so I am sympathetic as to why they didn't do it. But if you have, if you're below 135% of the poverty line, you have very small contributions. And even up to 150% of the poverty line, slightly more in terms of what you spend, but not very much. It's after that that there is this area. Now, I mean, the good news and the bad news is it's only a matter of time until people start trying to drive the benefit through there. What I worry more about is there was too little reform, for my taste, in the Medicare Prescription Drug, Medicare Modernization Act, too little modernization and more in the way of a new benefit. And I don't have questions as to whether the seniors are better off. I have some major questions about whether my granddaughters are better off.
Next question. Who has it? Yes.
As a personal opinion, I gotta tell you that major reform scares me. And the failure by the policy wonks to bifurcate the problem into the questions of availability versus affordability seems so evident that it just cries for attention. So I'd like not to concern myself with my question with availability, because I do think we do provide health insurance. We don't have dead bodies on the street. But we do have some real problems with affordability. And it seems to me that the wonk community can address some of those issues, like liability caps, employer mandates, repeated procedures that cost $10,000, $12,000 a shot. And I don't hear anyone talking about that kind of thing. All that's incremental and can be done very easily, my observation.
Well, it can't politically be done easily. And there is some, at least, focused on part of that. I don't disagree that the issue of affordability and availability is a major one. It is a problem, depending on where you live, in terms of access. People do die earlier with avoidable illness, depending not just on whether they're uninsured, but also where they live. Some parts of the country have much more availability of community health centers, of rural health centers, of public hospitals, or other places that provide, or just charitable individuals and charitable sites. But there are other parts of the country where it's not so available, and you can have a hard time, particularly a hard time before you get to crisis. So I don't think it's a, I don't think it's an issue that we can just dismiss. Both the communities and the individuals who don't have some kind of insurance coverage get put at both financial risk and some health risk. But having said that, I am a supporter of doing something about liability reform. There's debate about how much it adds, but I think it's not the question of the direct cost of the premium. The defensive medicine that it inspires is very unhelpful, and it particularly feeds into a payment system that is also not helpful. Unfortunately, this is a very partisan issue. There's some hope, but not during an election, that maybe by trying to tie some of the efforts at liability reform to patient safety and quality improvements, you might begin to build a coalition. But I'm not real optimistic. There's a lot of money at stake. The trial lawyers are a very strong, powerful group, and it has become a very tough political division. So that's a really tough political and partisan issue. We have a major problem in that in healthcare, our whole reward system is messed up, and Medicare leads the way. In terms of not rewarding performance. There is increasing attention that has come about since the first of the major Institute of Medicine reports on patient safety that was released in 1999, called To Err Is Human, that let out the secret that those of us who've been involved in healthcare financing and delivery have known for a long time, which is that there are a lot of avoidable patient deaths that happen because there are not the systems in place to prevent them. It is very serious. The payment system doesn't reward physicians who do it better. Medicare is particularly egregious, and having spent the last 20 years figuring out the right and just price for either a hospital discharge or a physician service, not in any way recognizing that best in class in every other area gets paid more, should get paid more, doesn't happen in healthcare, and in fact really goes the other direction. As you've indicated, if you screw it up, you get paid a second time unless you cross a particular Medicare line. So if you readmit somebody within 30 days, you'll trigger a flag. But if you readmit somebody in 33 days, unless there's something else going on in your system of care, you may not, in fact, trigger anything. So the notion of paying for performance, rewarding the institutions and the physicians that do it better the first time, is an area that's getting a lot of attention. The public sector is sponsoring some work in this area. I personally believe it'll happen fastest in the private sector because there's much more flexibility. Changing payment in the public sector requires passing new laws, and people will argue and fight about how to do it right. They won't argue about the principle, but the specifics. I've just been appointed to a new Institute of Medicine study that will begin this summer. It's a three-year study on redesigning health insurance benefits, payments, and pay for performance. So it will be a group that meets very frequently for the next 3 years, and hopefully we will be able to offer up ideas about how to get around this. But you're absolutely right. It is a very serious issue. And in a country that isn't going to put global budgets in place, isn't going to arbitrarily limit by age or other observable areas of national policy how we control healthcare spending, this is our best shot. Getting better information about what works when and rewarding the institutions and people who do it better. Because we're not going to do what other countries do, which is put a fiscal limit through the budget process. Here's what we're going to spend. We may not spend it well, but that's where we're going to stop. We're seeing the kind of frustration that's been producing in physician area of Medicare, where there is a tie to growing total physician spending according to the economy's growth, which is pretty dumb, but that is what we have in statute. And we are finding great frustration and a lot of worry about whether seniors are going to be able to get to see their physicians under Medicare because of this arbitrary rule. We're not going to go there for the rest of spending.
Well, we've come to our normal adjournment time. If there was one absolutely essential question one of you had, well, we could honor that. If not, we want to thank you. We've had several presentations by people who have some of the same characteristics you do, and maybe that gives us as much hope as anything else that the women and men both are attacking this problem with immense vigor, and you certainly have in dozens of different areas where you've worked, advisor to foundations, advisor to corporations, and all the rest, and it's been a privilege to have you with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Thank you.